From Los Angeles, I'm John Moe, in for Bill Radke.
And I'm Barbara Bogue, this week in Philadelphia, which used to be our nation's capital. In fact, I think the whole Philadelphia has a chip on its shoulder shtick probably started right then, back in 1800, when Philly lost out to Washington, D.C.
It's deep-seated.
It goes way back. In Philadelphia's heyday, though, George Washington and John Adams lived in a colonial red brick executive mansion just a block north of Independence Hall, right where the Liberty Bell is on display now. And that's where President Washington began to organize his government. It's also where he kept slaves. Now, the land of the free was founded by slave owners, but that fact hasn't exactly been played up in the history books or in historical exhibits until now. Right now, if you go to the National Constitution Center on Independence Mall, you can judge five different models of what the President's House Memorial should look like and sound like to try to tell this history. And it's all due to the work of historians and activists like Ed Lawler and Michael Cord. Gentlemen, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Same here. Nice to be here.
Ed Lawler, I'm going to turn to you for the history first. How was it that George Washington owned slaves in Pennsylvania in the 1790s? Wasn't it illegal to own slaves in that state?
Yes, it was. Philadelphia was the national capital from 1790 to 1800, and Pennsylvania had been the first government in the Western Hemisphere to outlaw slavery in 1780. But George Washington, as a citizen of Virginia, was able to bring slaves and hold them in Pennsylvania for up to 6 months. In November of 1790, Washington brought 8 enslaved Africans to the household, and that number decreased over the course of his presidency. I guess there were 3 at the end of his presidency.
Well, how much is known about their lives?
Oney Judge was about 16. She was Martha Washington's body servant. She helped her dress and bathe. There was Moll, who was in her mid-50s, and she was the nanny for Martha Washington's 2 young grandchildren. Hercules, who was in his probably early 40s, was the main cook at the president's house. And he specifically asked Washington permission to bring his 12-year-old son, Richmond, who was also in the kitchen. Austin, who was a footman, he was about in his early 30s. He was Oney Judge's older brother. Giles, who worked in the stables, was a coachman, was almost the same age as Austin. Paris, who was about 18 and was the stable boy. And Christopher Shields, who was 15 when he came to Philadelphia, who was Washington's body servant, so that he helped Washington dress and shave.
Well, Michael Cord, I want to bring you into the conversation. Did you know all this history before you got involved with the project?
I did not know it all. I knew some. Generally, I knew that George Washington owned black folks as slaves, but I didn't know the harshness in which he treated them. We figured that he was a great president or great general and might think that he's a great man, but we find out that the story about the wooden teeth, not as accurate as we were led to believe, that he had the teeth of some enslaved Africans in his mouth, that he signed the fugitive slave law, that he was known to be harsh in his dealing with recalcitrant enslaved Africans. So, again, maybe a great president, maybe a great general, but not a great man.
And President Washington signed the fugitive slave law while in the White House in Philadelphia. So what was involved in coming to a consensus with the city and with the National Park Service that at least this is an important site worth commemorating in some way?
It's been a long road. Michael and I have been at this now for 4.5 years.
Yes.
And I published my article in February of 2002. And then Michael organized the Avenging the Ancestors Coalition and started his letter-writing campaign and started holding protests at the Liberty Bell site. And their amplification of things really forced Independence Park to take action.
You know, I grew up in Philadelphia and went to Independence Park, and that's where the Liberty Bell is and Independence Hall and also the Mint and Benjamin Franklin's house. But there's no President's House. Why not?
Well, the unfortunate truth is that some of the walls were still standing in the 1950s, and they tore down the walls of Washington's White House to build a bathroom.
A public bathroom?
a public bathroom that stood on the site for 49 years and was torn down in May of 2003. But the house stood about 500 feet north of Independence Hall. This is where the cabinet met. This is where Washington met with generals. This is where he met with advisors. This is where he met foreign diplomats. And this is where he was presented to the public. Washington added a semicircular bow window to the state dining room to create a formal space in which the president could meet the public. It's the sort of thing where you waited in the front room, and then on a signal, Washington would come in a back door and be in front of these three windows facing south. And this worked especially well in the afternoon because it was backlit. And then you'd open up the French doors, and there was Washington, who was like 6 feet three, standing in front of these three windows 40 feet ahead of you, looking like a god. And you would come forward and bow to him, and he would bow back. So it was very dramatic. Washington had a very good sense of the dramatic.
I know you two have been working on this for years, and you've met a lot of resistance from the National Park Service, and now you're working with those folks to make this site happen. That must be an odd coalition.
Well, I can say for me it's truly odd. I was a student activist in college. I was a student activist in law school. I was an activist when I left law school. And I'm used to raising hell and yelling and screaming at people. And
then graduating.
Absolutely. And it's just amazing to me that the very same people that I started yelling at and screaming at, I'm sitting at the table and hammering out a resolution.
Well, now you have various interpretations of the site. What happens now?
We decide, at least the mayor does, and the Independence National Historical Park folks, with the input from the public and the mayor's oversight committee, and a decision is made about which model will be selected. I'm sure there's going to be some suggestions and revisions, and we expect a public unveiling October 2007.
Thank you very much for the conversation, both of you.
Thank you, and we hope to be back to do this sometime soon.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Ed Lawler is a historian with the Independence Hall Association. Michael Cord is the founder of ATTAC, Avenging the Ancestors Coalition. And those five designs for the new President's House Memorial I told you about earlier are on our website, weekendamerica.org. One proposal calls for just 9 chairs, one for each slave. Another one uses sound in an interesting way. As you're walking around, you hear the voices of Washington and other historic figures in the foreground, and you hear the whispering of slaves and servants as well. It's kind of an upstairs-downstairs effect.
Mm. Joseph Becton is a park ranger at Independence National Park in Philadelphia. That's a difficult job when you think about it. Not only does he need to have a full understanding of Washington's residence and who else lived there and the overall history of the site, but he also needs to be able to talk about the complex and thorny issues that surround something like that.
There's a number of core elements, if you will, that we want to be perceivable in the monument. We want to have an emphasis on how this was a dichotomy in America. You know, on one side, we have this massive struggle for a republic and to define a free republic. And on the other side, we have a country that's enslaving hundreds of thousands of people. So we want this to come out. And, of course, it's very relevant when you look just a little bit further, when you see the tower of Independence Hall. Independence Hall is oftentimes thought of being the beacon of freedom. So it's very interesting when you see that in the shadow of the beacon of freedom, the father of the United States of America enslaved 9 African people here. So we don't want that to be overlooked. And many times we've been accused of that in the Park Service by the press and by certain other elements in the community that we were even hiding. And I don't think that we were hiding, but we haven't emphasized.
There's an old saying that history is written by the winners. The people who ended up with power get to decide how they will be remembered. They usually pick heroes. But Ranger Joseph Becton sees this project as a chance for African Americans whose ancestors were enslaved to finally write their chapter.
You know, people a lot of times don't really see it. But American freedom wouldn't exist without American slavery. You know, part of the working man defining what was freedom for him was looking at the enslaved person and saying, I know I'm free because I'm not him. And from there, that was his foundation to build on it. After that, then the African people struggled to the right to be married, the right to serve in the army, the right to own property, every different thing that defines what freedom is had to be struggled for. It was fought for in the courts, fought for in the battlefields, fought for in the streets. Okay? So that's why I say that it must be that civil rights movement, you know, that has put us in a position now to help define and interpret American history.
That was Joseph Becton, a ranger at Independence National Historic Park in Philadelphia, where the city and the National Park Service are planning to open a President's House site that will focus on slavery in early American history.